morning. Well, I couldn't even get that word out. Good morning.
There we go. Start.
Yeah, that's good. A little hiccup in my voice there. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 28th of August. It is 14 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock, and we welcome you and thank you for being here. It's always nice to have you and to know that you're there listening. We have a lot to talk about today. Some interesting topics, I think. Hopefully you will feel the same and want to play ball with us. All you have to do is write to us, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. So let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Excellent. We also welcome Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing great, Joe. And Sarah, I always think when I hear the Justice Center of the cartoons that I used to watch in the 70s, it sounds like one of the superhero
Meanwhile, at the Justice Center.
I do have a bat cave. It's a perk.
As you should.
Just a PSA, Joe. Remember, kids are back to school. Watch the school bus, please. And today is Red Wine Day, which I think is associated with the kids going back to school.
Goes hand in hand. Yes. Sure, absolutely.
Or hand in glass, yes.
All right, so we are... we also are going to, I think, be joined by Mike Spain. We had a last-minute cancellation this morning, panelists who took ill, so we called up our friend Mike Spain, who is going to do it. We're just working on the technology, and he should be with us soon. And if not, we'll be fine. But plenty of things to talk about, but we do look forward to having Mike join us as always. Let me... go to our stories. Again, a reminder, panel at wamc.org if you would like to join us this morning. So let us begin. There's so many things to talk about, but let me let me begin with the indictment revision. And thank God we have a legal voice on the program here. But... So federal prosecutors on Tuesday issued a pared-down version of an indictment accusing former President Donald Trump of plotting to overturn the 2020 election, stripping out some charges and tweaking others to help the case survive the Supreme Court's recent ruling granting former president's broad immunity. The revised indictment issued in federal district court in Washington represented an attempt by prosecutors in the office of the special counsel, Jack Smith, to preserve the bulk of their case against the former president while bringing the allegations into line with the Supreme Court's landmark ruling that former presidents are immune from criminal prosecution for many official acts taken while in office. It kept the basic structure of the first indictment issued nearly 13 months ago, which accused Mr. Trump of intersecting plots to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The thrust of the changes was to remove any discussion from the indictment of any allegations that might be construed as related to Mr. Trump's official acts as president, while also contending that other acts should be interpreted as the conduct of a private candidate for office. All right. While we let that sink in, I woefully turn to Sarah Rogerson just to say, but he's president. So it's right.
Why so glum?
Well, I'm not glum. I just don't understand it. So the official act and an unofficial act. So,
right.
And so you write the revision as if he were a private candidate.
Right. Well, and they stripped out. This is actually a great example for a fact investigation class, because what is happening here is the special prosecutor, who is not new, by the way. He's a pretty intense guy, and he most recently, I was looking into him because I was like, who is this guy? He had been serving as the top prosecutor investigating war crimes in Kosovo in The Hague before he was called to serve his country in this capacity. And he's like a really low profile person. It's really hard to find out information about him, which is perfect. So that's a strategic appointment. But then in his lawyering strategy, which I don't know the guy and I don't pretend to be half the lawyer that he is, but what he's doing is reframing the facts that exist, eliminating facts that are no longer useful, thanks to the Supreme Court, and then restringing other facts together to prove the same point that fit within the narrow parameters set by the Supreme Court. So in language that is more accessible, he's tweaking the indictment to show clearer pathways to the same outcome based on the Supreme Court's feedback. So it's just a different path to the same end. And maybe it doesn't end there. Maybe there aren't enough facts along the way. But what Donald Trump has been very good at doing is creating a lot of facts and right. spilling them out into the public. So like, one of the things that the special prosecutor is doing to tweak his arguments is to make the argument that because Donald Trump has been so prolific on Twitter/X, and because he has mixed the personal use and the professional use, that muddies the waters
right.
in terms of what's professional and what's personal and what's in official capacity versus unofficial capacity.
Don't think me daft. However, When
never.
When I was looking at this,
really?
I thought of those things you see on the internet or in newspapers used to be years ago, where they would say the 4-ingredient chocolate cake. You can make it a great chocolate cake using only 4 ingredients, and I always thought, well, like why are you limited to 4? Like, okay, I guess that's fun. But you could still make it just the normal way, right? And this seems like that. Like you're making this indictment now using the very limited ingredients that you're being given.
Sometimes I'm so glad you raised that. My son, this week, my kids are sometimes unattended in this gap between camps ending and school beginning.
Yeah.
But
they're not infants, by the way.
No, no, he's 14.
Yeah, okay.
So it was a couple of hours. So I said, I'm coming home. He said, great, I made you something. And immediately I was like, did you turn the oven off? But what he made was 4-ingredient brownies with Nutella, flour, salt, and eggs. And they were, no joke, the most delicious brownies I have ever had in my life. So sometimes...
I hope this is a delicious indictment.
In the right hands, you know? Well, also, I mean, the special prosecutor is also talking to a judge that is thinking about being appealed, because that's what's going to happen. That's what Donald Trump does. Like, a verdict will come down and there will be appeals and challenges. So the judge has to be shown the way to fit things together in a way that makes their rulings more likely to survive additional challenges. And that's what the prosecutor's job is to do then, to make that slice.
Bob?
So I am much more optimistic, Joe. you know, first, I will state again that I think the Supreme Court right now is illegitimate. And if you have no ethics and no morals, you can't have justice. I think that they purposely bent over backwards and tried to protect Donald Trump, the person, in ways that's dangerous to the country. So I need to just sort of put my own bias out there. I think Jack Smith deserves an awful lot of credit. I sort of felt like they were floundering around after the Supreme Court and that not much was getting done and that there was supposed to be a hearing coming up, I think, on September 5th. This is what he did. He rewrote in the superseding indictment, keeping the same four charges, cleaning it up. He knocked out one of the four unindicted conspirators, which we believe, according to sources, was Jeffrey Clark. He made this very clear line between the private traitor Trump and the public president Trump, which I think was the effort that Sarah, you were talking about, is about how to sort of weave between the limitations that the Supreme Court placed on how a former president could be held responsible for actions. They impaneled a new grand jury, a brand new grand jury, and that indictment came in. So there's almost a, while this is a reset, it's almost a clean start, thinking about exactly the issues that Sarah raised, thinking about what comes next. I will put out to everybody again that Trump's running is as much about his ability to pardon himself as it is any care for the country. And I think we sort of lose track of that in a lot of the other swirl and chaos that is of Donald Trump. The big thing, and a couple of points that I thought were really interesting too, is that the language used shows the thing that the January 6th was a private event. It was for private purpose. His attorneys were private attorneys, that there is a clear line in this indictment between the private aspects versus the public, which is exactly, you know, trying to clarify the Supreme Court's concerns or obstacles, depending on which way you want to look at it. And even the language they used, for about Pence's role, was ceremonial versus an official act. So I think Jack Smith deserves an awful lot of credit. I was really glad to see that he had taken these efforts and that things were moving along. And I think this restarts the Chutkin case. Is that how she pronounced it? Chutkin?
Oh, I'm not sure.
The judge's right case, and it shows again. I think it raises again significant issues about what occurred on January 6th, which are, you know, frankly being rewritten because of Trump's lies.
I do believe Mike Spain is in our ears, and there's no better sound than that. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Oh, good morning. Happy to be here. I certainly like to weigh in on this one. I agree with you, Bob. I'm refreshed that Prosecutor Jack Smith has been able to identify charges that citizen Donald Trump may have committed, and apparently a fresh new grand jury hearing the evidence, just the evidence that is against somebody acting on his own behalf, not somebody acting in an official capacity as president of the United States. That alone, just his own activities, have crossed over, and it is a case to be made that he committed felonies. And, you know, what he did the president of the United States has no official role in the certification of the next president. That's Congress, and as you say, maybe an official, I mean, a ceremonial role for the vice president, but the president has no role in that. So he was acting on his own. It was a private event that happened on January 6th. And now sometime in the future, it looks like he'll be held accountable for it, unless, of course, as was the case with Mar-a-Lago and the classified documents, if Trump is elected to a new term in November, he would be able to have his Justice Department probably drop the charges, and it certainly would put off any accountability. But hoping for him to be held accountable at one point.
What about what you said, Sarah, earlier, that this is where this is headed, is to appeal. So vague, in the minute that we have before a break, vague timeline, no way of knowing, right?
There's no way of knowing.
Yeah.
But I'm sure Chutkin is, and I think that's how you pronounce her name, is mindful of the election timeline And being mindful not to do or say anything that would sway the election, which is another concern that the prosecutor has to weigh and balance in the language in his indictment.
In the indictment joke, can I just go off of Sarah's point?
It was
outside of the 60-day sort of freeze zone that Department of Justice has as far as court cases, too, which I thought was really interesting.
Right. So they're down to the wire, right? And then you get it in, and then you work on this post-election. Is that what sounds right?
Well, you keep working on it. It's just that, you know, the language
of the court action.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with our terrific panel, Sarah Rogerson, Bob Griffin, and Mike Spain. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. And when we return, we'll continue on this subject. We welcome your letters, and we'll move on to other stuff as well after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. I just wanted to touch on something that that was mentioned earlier. And this is, Bob mentioned this, the indictment was filed in advance of the onset of the so-called 60-day rule, an unwritten internal Justice Department practice that calls for avoiding taking overt prosecutorial steps that could influence how people vote within 2 months of an election. The other thing that I just wanted to look at, too, it is Tanya Chutkan is the name of the justice. And the new indictment comes as Mr. Trump's lawyers and Mr. Smith's deputies were scheduled to provide the judge overseeing the case with their proposals for how to assess the impact of the case of the Supreme Court's immunity decision. The two sides are still expected to file papers to the judge tomorrow, suggesting how they would like to move forward. So obviously this is a new wrinkle in that plan, and yet that plan will still go on.
Yes. So if you ever get curious about how why the legal system works that it does, I mean, first you have to take civil procedure, but you could also take a look
at a talk show.
You could take a look at you take a look at PACER, which is the electronic case filing system for the federal courts. And you can download dockets and see like all the different steps that have to be taken at each step of the process. And that is by design, not to frustrate the general public, not to cause confusion, and not to necessarily incentivize delay. It's to protect the process and to make sure that people who are not Donald Trump are not subjected to an expedited process where careful steps aren't taken. And it's federal district court. These are courts that are deliberative. The judges that preside over them take their jobs very seriously, even the ones that were appointed by Trump. It's just how they wield that power. But it's a deliberative, careful process where every single step along the way has like six or seven other steps involved. And that's due process in America. But the alternative is worse. So it's better to get to the correct outcome slowly than to respond to or have politically motivated deliberations in the justice system. I mean, this is how it's supposed to happen. And I keep thinking that the judge that's presiding over this particular case against Donald Trump, because there are many, is an immigrant. She was born in Kingston, Jamaica. And I just keep thinking how much that must be driving him nuts more than anything else that's happening.
You know, it just doesn't I understand all of the legal arguments, and I understand what you are saying, and I even to Mike's point of being refreshed by this, but it's hard to get over the, at least in my case, the initial annoyance that you can't include information where the sitting president of the United States is having conversation with his White House aides and the White House lawyer. That I'm not saying it makes it a slam dunk, but by the same token, certainly gives it much more new. It certainly bolsters that case.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with Mike Pence then, because one of the biggest pieces of this case were the conversations that did or didn't happen on January 6th between then outgoing President Donald Trump and Pence, who became at some point the subject of Trump's attacks and the subject of incitement to violence, like, and alternatively was having back channel conversations with Pence about presiding over the Senate and interfering with the vote confirmation.
So, and is there a, and I don't know if I'm using, probably not using the right terminology here, but is there the point where he is not the sitting vice president who's presiding over this this duty of finally confirming the election, to take that role as sitting vice president versus that of a potential victim?
Yeah, well, there was, I remember very clearly, shortly after January 6th, or maybe on that day, because I don't know, my brain retains information strangely, but Pence had at some point separated himself from the Secret Service detail that was assigned to him because he was afraid about whether or not the detail was protecting him or carrying out the wishes of Donald Trump.
During the hearings on this, there was video of him in the hallway, like mm-hmm. where those deliberations were being made.
Right.
In the stairwell, right, where he was,
where all good deliberations are made.
Well, I mean, they had ushered him out of the building, and it was like, where do you want him? They were telling him where they wanted him to go, and he was like, meh.
He refused to go with them. They wanted to take them out. My recollection is it was down by the vehicles.
Okay.
But this is though, Joe, why I thought the distinction between an official act versus a ceremonial act was a really important distinction that again it's trying to ensure that even in the wildest Trump support on the Supreme Court that they're not able to go back and undermine this again. I mean, because the population that Smith has got to look at is, this is going to end up in front of the Supreme Court again. So how do you try to bulletproof this as much as you possibly can?
Mike?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that the part that is encouraging to me is that all of this was put before the new grand jury was filtered to remove anything that might have given the Trump side an argument that it's executive privilege or whatever the Supreme Court, the limited immunity or the presumed immunity that the president has when he acts officially. And, as far as Pence goes, is he going to be a witness in this trial?
I don't know. I just searched for his name in the indictment, and it appears like every other page. I have to imagine someone at some point is going to, well, in a particular section. So, but there's.
Right.
Yeah, between pages 21 and 32, there are like 7 to 9 occurrences of Pence's name.
Hmm. No, that's so that would, if it was not, it, because it's in there, I guess what I'm trying to say is because it's in there, evidently the prosecutor and the people believe that that those were not official presidential acts, those conversations or those, those actions that the president took regarding Pence on that day are not part of his official duties, which is, I think, opens him up for, some serious consequences when this gets on trial.
Yeah, but if you my concern, Mike, though, is that if you look at the dissent, which Jackson Brown's dissent specifically, she calls out Roberts and the conservatives for basically contorting themselves to try to bubble wrap Trump. And even if you think about what the Supreme Court did with the immunity ruling is that it was vague. I think it was done purposely vague so they could get multiple bites at the apple if they wanted it. It was intended to address and protect Donald Trump rather than create a body of law, which is the responsibility of the Supreme Court. That's my interpretation of it.
Oh, 1,000%. I mean, and that's a lot of their rulings. But this one in particular, they were trying to thread a really narrow needle in making sort of like a ruling that wouldn't be permanent, but was temporarily important.
A ruling that wouldn't apply to Biden, but would apply to Trump,
right?
You know, that type of thing.
Do you think that? Do you think? I mean, it's likely that Trump's attorneys will say that even this indictment covers official acts, and therefore they'll appeal it on that. I mean, not appeal the outcome, but fault the case to bring that argument to the Supreme Court and get them to rule on it, or a circuit court to rule on it before this trial is allowed to go forward. I mean, whatever delays it is good for the former president, right?
Yeah, they'll use whatever, and this goes back to those rules of civil procedure. They'll use whatever tool they have available to them that was intended to protect average ordinary citizens or even extraordinary journalists and other politicians doing the right thing from being attacked. And they're going to use it as a delay tactic to keep this from really being in the headlines between now and November.
Except, though, Sarah, I actually think it depends on what the polls say. If Trump is able to do a massive fundraiser off of this, which he has been able to do off of his other indictments, I don't understand it. But again, we've seen it happen.
Mm-hmm.
This his campaign is drowning right now, and anything that they could do to sort of change the narrative is something they could use. So they actually could elevate this. Rather than try to hide it.
Totally. That's why I love being a lawyer. Because there are rules and there are tools, and then you use them there are tools that speed things up and there are tools that slow things down, and there are rules that speed things up. And if the defense says, yeah, we want this to go quickly, Jack Smith is ready. Jack Smith. That sounds like a superhero name.
Jack,
too.
Yeah.
What is that?
I know.
And
Jack Sparrow?
Jack Sparrow. Yeah.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have letters. We'll move on to other topics. And we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable discussion this morning. We have been talking about Jack Smith, special prosecutor, who has revised the Trump indictment in the January 6th case. The filing in the case charging the former president with plotting to overturn the 2020 election came in response to the Supreme Court's ruling giving former presidents broad immunity. We have been discussing that this morning with our panel. We now open it up to you and have some letters to go through. We begin with Charles, who says, in the return to the seemingly endless cycle of daily updates to Trump's legal woes, what seems to get lost, or that the mainstream media has forgotten, is that Trump is out on bail, even in cases that are not in his in this hour's headlines. Am I wrong on this point about him being out on bail? Personally, I think this should be mentioned more often. I don't Mike, do you know the answer to that?
I don't know that he had to put up a bail bond for the. You're talking about the case in New York City involving,
correct,
you know, the payoffs to the porn star. That case. Bail is to ensure that someone is going to show up. I don't know that there was a doubt that he wouldn't show up. I mean, I think that's, you know, what do you think?
The Georgia case, there wasn't bail.
I don't
remember.
I don't either.
It's a good point. I mean, we don't talk enough about the fact that he's actually a convicted felon. You know, and I mean, I apparently he's already voted in Florida, which
I don't
understand.
I watched the convention last week, and they mentioned it a lot.
Well,
true.
I will.
Well, and I'm sure they also there was also probably paperwork filed to appeal the conviction as well. So I don't know if that puts a stay on his status of having been convicted. I don't know.
I mean, if you've paid a bond, are you then out on bail?
No, the bond was for the defamation case. He had to put up a bond because he couldn't come up with the...
That's for the E. Jean Carroll case.
Yeah,
okay.
I believe. Well, maybe I'm wrong about that. There was also a settlement in order to satisfy the, while he appeals the case against New York State, the one that Letitia James brought against the Trump Corporation. The Trump Corporation also paid only a partial amount while that case is appealed. Ordinarily, you don't get a buy. You have to pay the fine, and it was like $500 million fine, and he couldn't come up with the money. So he came up with a partial payment, and the court agreed to it, gave him a break. But, yeah, I don't know if he's actually out on bail, but, yes, he's a convicted felon. And, that's commonly said by his opponents politically.
Just for our listeners, I'm just having huge sympathy for Sarah right now, who's going through bar exam and LSAT PTSD with some of these questions.
Yeah, I like bond and bail are used, basically both are used to control and coerce behavior of people who have been convicted of certain crimes. So it for different reasons.
But again, Jed, let's take this up 1,000 feet, though.
Yeah.
Think about this, that we're talking about, again, about all of these cases about a man who wants to be president of the United States and is representing one of the two leading parties. I mean, it's just, I mean, how much more unfit does somebody need to be than this man is?
Well, and I'll up you one. And he's a whisker in the polls away from his challenger.
Yes. And a month and a half ago, he had a commanding lead.
Right. So not only is there that of the fitness for office, but how the electorate sees that and how they weigh that as something that will bother them or not.
Well, what the Democrats need to do is not bank on that.
Right.
Yeah. Like, it really needs to be, the Democrats need to offer a vision.
Well, I think that's where the letter comes from, right? Is saying we're not mentioning it enough. And yet, I think, to your point, I think the Democrats aren't banking on it. So they just sort of said, okay, well, let's talk about the stuff that's right in front of us that we can actually grab a hold of.
Well, because what's motivating voters to go to the polls is not whether or not Donald Trump has been indicted. What's motivating people to go to the polls is whether or not they can feed their family, whether or not the Democrats do a good job of educating everybody on Donald Trump's tax policy and how it actually hurt rather than help the middle class. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there, of course, about a lot of the things that he did while he was in office. And it's tough, and I know it's really, really difficult to do this, but the Democrats have to figure out a way to explain in very simple TikTok-y type terms why economic cycles and political cycles are not necessarily linked and why, and that's a double-edged sword, of course, because the economy is improving on the way to the election. So they kind of want to, like, you know, benefit from that upswing while also educating the American public about why another 4 years of Donald Trump could mean long-lasting negative impact for their individual pocketbooks moving forward. And by them, I mean, like, undecided voters in the middle class.
Right. This from Deanne. Sure, the system is set up to protect the innocent. The problem is that the poor little guy who can't afford a lawyer or bail gets sent to jail to await his trial for long periods, and then the rich or powerful guy who manages to get to the presidency and can afford the fancy lawyers gets to put off, and put off his trials and eventually possibly pardon himself. This all seems very unjust to me.
That's 1,000% right. And that's why New York has repeatedly chipped away at cash bail, and why criminal justice reform has in large part been working for the benefit of working class and poor folks in New York State.
And it's also, Trump has created, he's created this sort of Festivus pull of complaints about how poorly he's been treated, but he manipulates the system in ways that frankly, Joe, you and I couldn't afford to if we were in a similar situation.
And you should add to that too that this money isn't coming out of Donald Trump's pocket. This is money he's raising, legal defense funds, and some of those very people that wouldn't be able to come up with money for a good legal defense or maybe cover bail are. That people are being nickel and dimed and dollared to pay for this defense that Trump is putting up.
This guy's the biggest grifter in American history.
Tom writes to us and says, okay, talk about being triggered. This January 6th discussion makes me want to jump out of my skin. Mm-hmm. Trump is a flat-out insurrectionist, and almost 4 years later, he's still out there flapping his pie hole and proving no rules apply to him. He was told he couldn't use Arlington, and he did it anyway. We'll get into that in a minute. There's no enforcement in this country. If this had been in the UK or Germany, he would have been dragged off of the stage at the Ellipse, and rightly so.
Now, I'm not quite so sure they would have dragged him off the Ellipse. I think there would have been there's certainly a different set of justice. I think one of the things that I personally find so disgusting is the complete rewrite of what occurred on January 6th. This idea that somehow they're victims, that there's actually a January 6th anthem that, I mean, we all saw it. We all watched it. And the fact that he's been able to sort of rewrite this and create any sympathy to the traitors that were there and stormed the Capitol, I don't think the terms the prison terms are long enough. And I know there's another story, I don't know if we're going to get to it, about the one of the first people into the Capitol just got 4 years, and I think it should have been 40.
Bill writes, how does a convicted, and then in shouty caps, convicted, exclamation point, felon vote in the state of Florida?
I actually don't have a problem with convicted felons voting. I mean, I think it's easy to pile on when it's a character that you and your friends don't like Donald Trump. But there are a lot of people who would fall into that category, who should have access to the ballot, who should be able to exercise their rights. Like, a felony status is a brand, like the kind that that mark you, not the kind that you market. But, I think we need to be really careful. And this is why the justice system is treating Donald Trump the way that it is, so that we don't make rules for him that we wouldn't want to apply to other more sympathetic characters.
So, and I certainly understand your points. My understanding from the law in Florida is that unless he is incarcerated for his felonies in New York at the time of the election, then he is able to vote in Florida.
Which is actually pretty progressive for Florida. Honestly. I'm not mad about that.
Go Florida.
They're so woke.
Donald Trump's vote for himself, first of all, it's a given. Second of all, it's one of a sea of votes. Like, it's nothing. It's ceremonial. It's symbolic. And it's funny that he did it early in advance of this trial, because I think he knew.
It is. But what's not funny, though, is that, you know, you look at the attack on the voting systems. You look at the cries of voter fraud, which he made even yesterday in an absolute wacko interview with Dr. Phil. And, you know, just be careful. I mean, take advantage of today's red wine day if you're going to watch that thing.
Words that Roger Mudd probably never had to say during his newscast. Yeah. But president and talks to Dr. Phil.
If you look at like what Abbott just did in Texas and this idea of this drumbeat about voter fraud I don't know. There's these double standards that are going on. It's a continually undermining by the GOP of some of the core institutions of this country and. The you know what you're going to reap what you sow, and what they're sowing right now is really bad for the future of this country.
All right, let's take a break. We are late, and when we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss, lots of stories, and a wonderful panel to mull them over with, and a wonderful audience as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after news with Ray Graff. Guitarist Frank Vignola is who we're listening to at this moment. Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs on Friday the 30th, which I believe is the day after tomorrow. And Frank will be playing Cafe Lena with Pasquale Grasso. We're playing Grasso music tomorrow, which will be cool. And you can find out more at cafelena.org. Don't forget two F's in cafe, cafelena.org. And you can see our playlist posted online at wamc.org, wamc.org. All right, let's go to back to the subjects at hand and want to talk about some new things this morning. And covering, we've been talking, of course, about the indictment, and there are many other stories to discuss, and a lot of them related and a lot of them not, but here we go. First of all, I think we can do this one quickly. After raising complaints, the former president, Donald Trump, now says he will participate in the debate with Kamala Harris. Over the weekend, he said he would not because ABC bad. And there was a dispute over the mics being open, and he suggested that he would he didn't say he would, he said he could skip it. Now, in a very, I think, very firm release, he said, "I have reached an agreement with the radical left Democrats." Mm. For a debate with comrade Kamala Harris, and confirming that there will be a debate September 10th in Philadelphia. Trump agreed earlier this month to take part in the ABC News debate, which will be his first debate against Harris since she replaced President Joe Biden as the Democratic presidential nominee. But Trump threw the debate into uncertainty Sunday when he criticized ABC as biased in a social media post and suggested people should stay tuned about his participation. The campaign spent Monday sparring over whether to preserve a rule from Trump's June debate against Biden where the candidates' microphones were muted when it was not their turn to speak. The Harris campaign said the microphones should be live throughout the September 10th debate, while Trump's campaign argued for the exact same terms from the June debate with CNN. Trump himself sent mixed messages we all look surprised, saying during a campaign stop in Virginia that the microphone muting doesn't matter to me and that he would rather have it probably on. But the agreement for the September 10th debate was that it was going to be the same as last time. Trump on Tuesday said the rules for the September 10th debate will be the same as the last CNN debate, which means that the microphones will indeed be muted. A lot went wrong, Mike Spain, with the last debate between President Joseph Biden and candidate Donald Trump. One of the things, maybe the only thing, that seemed to work was the muting of the microphones.
I think what you're seeing here is what we've been witnessing, and there's been a lot of reporting about it, and that is the sort of problems Trump's handlers, the people who are helping him make this candidacy for another term, want one thing. They wanted to talk about why Kamala Harris would be bad, why her policies would hurt people, and why his policies would be better. And instead, he just rattles off some of the same. I mean, even this statement, Comrade Harris, you know, he wants to denigrate, call people names, wants to be nasty. He can't help it. And they're trying to insulate him from that. Arguably, the same way the people who handled Joe Biden were trying to keep him from having too many confrontations with the media and had made sure that he had short times in front of the microphone with always having a teleprompter. Trump's handlers want him to keep the teleprompter. Of course, when he gets out there on the stump, I think we've witnessed in the last week, he veers off from the prepared statements and starts defaulting into the same narratives that he's been saying for months now, whether it's about how immigrants are stealing all the jobs and they're taking the jobs of the people of color in the United States. And, you know, he brings up Hannibal Lecter. He's brought him up more than 20 times. He, you know, and they just are afraid that if the microphone is open, people are going to see and hear some of that, which won't help Trump's image. And of course, I think that's exactly why Kamala Harris and her campaign is trying to get the microphones open. They want people to see Trump as he is, not just a filtered Trump, which is what they would see if his microphone was turned off.
Yeah, old, confused, and it's a constant temper tantrum. I mean, a toddler's temper tantrum is what we see with him. Joe, I still am not convinced that the debate's going to go on. I think he's going to try to hold it hostage again. Again, this is sort of his MO. The debate becomes, I think, even more critical to him given the trajectory of what we're seeing with polls. And again, you know, we can discuss whether you believe the polls or not. Mike, I think you're right. If I'm part of the Harris campaign, I want that microphone on so that everybody can see the unvarnished Donald Trump and frankly, his cognitive decline.
Well, especially since one of Kamala's great strengths and skills that she's shown on the campaign trail so far is managing temper tantrums. She's been very adept. I mean, there's one clip in particular that keeps circulating over and over again where she chides some protesters and says, "You can say what you want to say, but I'm speaking now." And then that gets the whole crowd riled up. And that is sort of a metaphor for the voting base, right? If she can do that to Trump on stage as a woman of color and sort of standing up to and managing his white fragility, male victimhood temper tantrum, that is not a good look for him. And in the code of American masculinity, it takes him right out at the knees. And so I don't even know if he'll stay on stage if she is able to manage him in that way.
The
I agree. Yeah, I agree with you, Bob, though. I'll believe it when I see it, when this debate happens. I mean, we've got, what, about not even 2 weeks, and about 2 weeks. And that gives him several more opportunities to pull out of it and then come back into it and pull out of it and then come back into it. And we'll just see what happens on the day of the debate.
And keep pulling as they go to see, like, should I stay or should I go? What do the polls say?
I find it interesting because I agree with all of you in the sense that I'll believe it when I see it of it actually happening. One of the things is that no matter whether it's an issue of the microphones or whatever, Trump has been complaining about ABC in this debate for weeks, for months, and it came to a real head when he spoke to the National Association of Black Journalists. And then an ABC journalist, Rachel Scott, got into it with him, rightfully so. And he again called her nasty, and then that was used as a reason too why he was apprehensive about doing the debate. We do know that in this debate that would take place on the 10th. Would be moderated by Lindsay Davis and David Muir of ABC. And that is according to ABC. They also were part of the 2020 presidential debate in February, primary debate that they hosted. Davis is an anchor on ABC News Live Prime, and David Muir, of course, is the host of World News Tonight and has been with the network since 2003. And so this is where it stands at the moment. And right, but any
but remember he ducked, successfully ducked the primary debates.
Yes.
And as far as the strategy, it worked for him. I'm not sure that he gains much. The other thing too is that what does he call Flopolopoulos? I mean, these childish names. It just reminds me of the immaturity of Donald Trump and the base level of chaos that he brings to everything. And you know, I'm sure I'm like a lot of the listeners, I'm just exhausted by him. He just needs to go away. You know, he really does. Just go away. And that's what I hope this election does, that it finally puts Donald Trump to bed.
I know, I don't think I've ever had to do this before, but I just a helpful hint for those of you if you're ever looking for this. But there is a Wikipedia page, which is of the nicknames used by Donald Trump.
So
what does he call Chris Christie? Well, it's Sloppy Chris. What does he call Elaine Chao? Coco Chao. So Alfred E. Newman is Pete Buttigieg. So if you're ever looking for the particular insult that he uses, there's a cheat sheet available to you on Wikipedia.
I remember when he did call Buttigieg Alfred E. Newman, and Buttigieg said, I had to go to the internet to look that one up.
Oh, God.
It shows you the generational differences.
Forget he's young. Okay.
He well, isn't this the first time, though, that it's not a commission that's selecting the moderators
for the
debate? So, I mean, I think that kind of cuts it, because that means his campaign has already agreed to these.
They already agreed.
Right.
I mean, that was the, yes. I mean, that was a lot of what was going on, I think, in post the Biden debate. As Biden was sort of spinning and saying the different things of reasons of what went wrong, and people, us on this panel, said, why did he do that?
Right.
I mean, the underlying, everything left brought us back to, he agreed to it. This was his, he wanted this debate at this time to show that he was capable, and this, so.
It just didn't work out.
It, so it's similar in that
arguably
sense.
Arguably, it worked out well.
Yeah, right.
Well, right, yes. Right. Depending on what side you're
for
on.
For the greater good.
Yes, yeah. Of how that.
It got it over early.
How that works out.
Well, because they shifted the timing and everything. It's almost, you know, in retrospect, we'll look at the timeline of all of these things, and it'll come into sharper relief, sort of, what the Democrats were thinking, which is
well,
still.
Well, it could be. Yeah, the September debate makes sense, the early debate in September, because people are already starting to vote in some states.
Yes.
So
definitely,
you know, holding it 2 weeks before or a week before misses a lot of people who vote by mail.
Yeah, I just mean the shift from the Biden ticket to the Harris ticket. And you know, I think people are just so gleeful about it that no one's really spent a lot of time thinking about how that happened, why that happened. I mean, we'll find out more years from now, but
I haven't been able to put my finger on it right away, and I had this question yesterday, and I looked really quickly. I didn't look intensely, but does anyone know offhand if is there going to be an audience?
Oh,
I think no.
Okay, just in a studio.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the best.
Is anybody amused by Trump saying, you know, I could go either way with the mics, but that's what we agreed to. He's trying to honor a commitment that was made earlier. I find that funny.
Yes.
But that was his big, I mean, and then he tried to float this erroneous idea that they had agreed to a Fox debate beforehand, and he wanted it in a stadium. And I mean, I think, you know, I'll be very surprised if the debate actually occurs. I think the downside for him, especially with the way I have been watching his public addresses, and Joe, they're wild. I mean, they are.
Oh, I know.
Mean, they're cuckoo for Cocoa Puff. They are so far out there, and that's not just a reference to the cereal he had behind him. And I just hated the waste of food that was sitting in the sun, but that's an editorial comment. He cannot stay on topic, and he rambles. And I mean, it.
So you're saying when he said if Jesus was the vote counter, he would have won
California, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I get the whole fishes and loaves, but I never heard Jesus in you know, increasing the number of votes. I mean, that's new.
So, bear with me. I'm gonna like just pull from my common sense brain and say, okay, but if you are Donald Trump, if you are looking, which this appears he is looking to be part of the conversation that for the first time in a very long time has gotten away from him, and a lot of the tricks in his book have not been winning. He also has been very critical of Kamala Harris for not holding any press conferences or not holding any interviews. I mean, then, and I know it doesn't make any sense, but I know it's just common sense, but how does that work out if those are your complaints and then you turn out and say, I'm not going to be a part of the debate?
Yeah, I think he needs the debate. He can't be, if he turns it down, and doesn't mean he won't turn it down. I think you're right, Bob. But if he turns it down, the look is very bad. It'll be portrayed as him essentially being afraid of a woman of color. And that is not a good look for him. On the other hand, he can certainly go on stage, and if he's disciplined and doesn't do a whole lot of damage, it probably would help him. And she needs the debate, too. I think it's that people will tune into the debate. I just think what he's doing now, yeah. You know, what he did this week, it's like when there's a big prize fight or a major wrestling match, but especially like, you know, when George Foreman and Muhammad Ali were heading for one of their big fights, you badmouth each other. You you say a bunch of things and you try to just get a lot of public interest in it. You might even talk about whether or not you're going to do it. And, you know, it's getting publicity. We're talking about it. And if he just said, I'll come to the debate as under the terms we agreed to and didn't say any more, we'd be talking about something else, maybe something less less positive. So
you make him sound like a casino fight promoter.
Yeah, very much, very much. That's what a huckster does. I mean, that is a skill of a huckster.
Just remember, he bankrupted a casino.
All right. So the other part of what I was just talking about is that one of the things that Trump has been going on, and many Republicans and journalists, I will add, have been finding fault with the Harris-Walz campaign, is that they have not done a press conference or a sit-down interview. That has now been set. They will have their first joint interview, and they'll do it on CNN. This is the first one since launching the campaign just about 5 weeks ago. And Kamala Harris had been facing a lot of pressure to participate in an on-the-record debate and an in-depth interview since she emerged as the Democratic presidential candidate last month. Now it has been announced that CNN's Dana Bash on Thursday will sit down with both Kamala Harris and Tim Walz and have a joint interview. It will be a special on CNN. I know that it is scheduled to air at 9 o'clock. I don't think it's going to be recorded. It is expected to take place while Harris and Walz are traveling through South Georgia on Thursday on a bus tour of the battleground state. And, of course, Dana Bash, a veteran of the network, was one of the moderators of June's presidential debate between Biden and former President Donald Trump. So, I guess we can put that one to rest, Mike?
Yeah, I guess. There'll be a lot of eyeballs on Thursday night. And it's funny, I guess, because the interview is going to be done during that bus trip through Georgia that you referenced. That explains why you have both candidates there. It seems a little unnecessary to have the ticket there. Usually it's just one. And it'll give people an opportunity to see the dynamic and the chemistry between Walz and Kamala Harris, you know, and that could be very favorable. If he's deferential to her and she's deferential to him, it might make them look more compatible, and that might allay some issues with people. I can't even imagine. Can anyone imagine a press conference or an interview with J.D. Vance and Trump together? They'd Mm-mm. be trying to talk over each other. It would be hysterical.
Well, either that or Vance would be silent and sort of chime in when he was given permission.
He might have been told ahead of time.
Yeah.
Don't say a word.
Sounds like a recasting of Dumb and Dumber. Mike, you just hit on something that was boiling my blood earlier. I was watching Fox's reaction to this announcement, and the way they downplayed Vice President Harris, like that she was a scared little girl because she couldn't go on without Walz. I thought it was so disgustingly misogynistic, and I was really, you know, I call it out because I was really offended by the way they were approaching this.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up more topics to discuss. I want to talk about Arlington. So we'll get into that when we come back, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Sarah Rogerson, Mike Spain, Bob Griffin, and your letters after this as we wrap up on this Wednesday edition of the Roundtable. A All right. We have 15 minutes together, and I think we can make the most of it. I want to go over a story, and then we have a lot of letters that have accumulated over the time that we've been together, and we'll get to as many of those as we can as we ride out the final moments of our time together. So let us go to the story. You know, I used to things like this, you go, oh, well, that's an odd story. And, you know, I mean, once you've had bears and brain worms, it just nothing is really all that odd anymore. But so Donald Trump visited Arlington Cemetery. This was on Monday. We'll get into the reason why in just a moment. And apparently there was an alleged altercation with his aides over photographing. An NPR source said that a cemetery official was pushed and verbally accosted as they tried to block campaign ads from photographing. Arlington National Cemetery officials on Tuesday acknowledged an unspecified incident, quote unquote, during Donald Trump's visit on Monday on the third anniversary of the Afghanistan withdrawal, as dueling allegations of misbehavior overshadowed an event to honor American war dead. An NPR report on Tuesday cited an unidentified source with knowledge of the incident who said Trump campaign staff pushed and verbally attacked a cemetery official who tried to stop them from taking photos and video in an area of the cemetery called Section 60. That is where many U.S. service members who died in recent conflicts are buried. The cemetery said in a statement that federal law bars photography for political campaign purposes at the site. But Trump campaign communications director Steve Achung said that there was no physical altercation as described, that the campaign was given permission to bring a photographer, and that it is prepared to release footage to defend against, quote, the defamatory claims. Chung also claimed, without providing evidence or details, that an unnamed individual clearly suffering from a mental health episode decided to physically block members of President Trump's team during a very solemn ceremony. Responding to an inquiry about an alleged altercation during Trump's visit, Arlington National Cemetery issued a statement that read, "We can confirm there was an incident, and a report was filed. The organization did not share more details. It was not immediately clear to whom the report was filed, but the incident occurred on U.S. Army property. Army headquarters and the service's criminal investigation division did not immediately respond to requests Tuesday night to the to the Washington Post for clarification." Visitors have long taken graveside photographs in Arlington, including in Section 60, but in a statement released Tuesday, defense officials drew a distinction between Trump's actions and those of typical visitors. Federal law prohibits political campaign or election-related activities within Army National Military cemeteries to include photographers, content creators, or other persons attending for purposes or in direct support of a partisan political candidate's campaign, according to the cemetery's statement. Arlington National Cemetery reinforced and widely shared this law and its prohibitions with all participants.
You know, it's a continued example of the contempt that Donald Trump holds for our military and our military traditions. If you've ever been to Arlington National Cemetery, you understand the extent of the sacrifice. And the Army's intent have always been to keep it a solemn and sacred ground, and to have it defamed in such a way for the most base political purposes is really horrible. And if Trump's folks have video, then bring it to the investigators. It should never have been even an issue because they knew what the rules were. They were told what the rules were. They were given the rules. And the defense I heard this morning was, well, the families that were involved gave us permission. That it doesn't matter what the families say. There are other families that are impacted by it. And the idea that you would use the fresh graves of fallen, of our fallen service people, is really, I think, again, going back to Trump's comments about the Medal of Honor being less important than him giving an award to someone who continues to fund his campaign, is the stolen valor of the presidential award versus the Congressional Medal of Honor, and it raises questions, continued questions about comments that I do believe Trump made about our wounded veterans, especially going back and seeing what General Kelly, Secretary Kelly, has said about it. It's a continued problem. I also saw some pictures that Trump took with family members at grave sites, doing a thumbs up, which I just thought, I mean, how absolutely inappropriate, callous, and careless can this man be?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I remember, I think the first time I went to Arlington was when I was 16 on like a band trip to Washington, D.C., right? And you do, the minute you're there, you know the rules, even if they haven't been explained to you, even as a kid. So I think the campaign knows that this is bad. they know that this is another problem for them. They're probably trying to figure out how to alter the video and audio that they have in a way that's believable in order to show it in a more favorable light to their version of the story. And I'm heartened by the statement from the cemetery officials that they are being 100% neutral. They are the guardians of the sacredness of the site, and they're that's guiding their conduct. It'll be interesting to see what happens as more information is revealed and how the stories shift and change.
Mike?
Yeah, ordinarily, if a former president of the United States, a former commander-in-chief, was invited to a ceremony at Arlington, it wouldn't be an issue. What complicates this is that it's happening during a campaign, and anything that Donald Trump does is part of his campaign right now. And, he's trying to sell everyone read today. He's getting ready to put some more NFTs, tokens available for people to buy and to raise money. I don't know if that goes to the campaign or to his pocket, but he's doing everything he does is to promote the campaign right now. And yes, Bob, you said it. They know the rules. And Sarah, you're exactly right. You go into Arlington and you immediately feel the solemnity of it. It's quiet. It's touching. It's a very moving experience to turn that into a sort of a carnival atmosphere, a circus atmosphere, to exploit it. I'm sure the photos, if this incident had not happened and they just did it and nobody stopped them, they'd probably be all over social media now raising money with it. I mean, it's despicable. It's typical. It's not surprising. And the final thing is how just horrendous it is for Chris LaCivita, the Trump spokesperson here, to say an individual is having a mental breakdown. That's what they attribute this to, that somebody was just so offended by it they stepped in front of the camera or something and said, "You can't do this. This is wrong." And that person's having a mental breakdown. I mean, it's never me. It's always the other person's problem. And that's exactly the way it is. Somebody to blame.
Yeah, well, but you know something? Chris made a deal with the devil. So if he's concerned about why he's in hell, that's his own fault.
Yeah, that already happened.
Well, and I can just imagine when the Arlington Cemetery officials heard that this visit was happening, that starting in that moment, they started to worry about what was going to happen. So I have every reason to believe that they had their top-notch folks on duty that day as well. So I don't for a second believe this story that somebody who was mentally unstable interfered with with Trump's campaign photographers.
They make it sound like some guy mowing the lawn came over and started yelling at them or something. You know what I mean?
Somebody wandered over from K Street and just decided to.
but think about it though, Mike. You know, it has flashes to me of Trump and Barr cleaning protesters out in front of the White House, so Trump could go over, could walk across the street to awkwardly hold up a Bible, which is
a Bible,
and not the ones that he was selling. This was,
another one.
They tear gassed American citizens who are exercising their freedom of speech in order to do a photo op in front of a church. And now you've got the desecration of one of our most sacred cemeteries in order to do a political campaign. Nothing is sacred to this man.
The one thing I would just like to add is just the sometimes I don't think we give our government enough credit, but the National Cemetery system throughout this country, our closest one is the National Cemetery in Schuylerville, the Solomon, Jerry Solomon National Cemetery. It is a beautiful, incredible, moving, solemn space. And if you're there to look, if you're there to attend a service or a ceremony, it is, I mean, talk about doing something just right and beautiful and so incredibly in every sense to honor those who have served the country. To have that pierced is, it just seems really awful.
I think of the contrast between the character and the dedication of people who dedicate their entire professional lives to the memories of the fallen.
Yes.
Versus the character of a Trump campaign photographer.
Right.
And the decisions that brought them to dedicate their passion towards that life goal. Those two things lie in stark contrast.
That's such a great point.
Yeah, and the way they downplayed 24 years of service for Walls that he made in the National Guard. His actual service.
Yeah.
Was labeled as stolen valor.
Yeah.
What did Libby Post call Trump yesterday? It was something like
President
Colonel
Bonespur. President Bonespur is actually.
President
Bonespur.
This is why she does what she does.
Yes, that's it. All right, friends, we are out of time. My thanks to all who were here with us this morning. Mike, thank you very much for looking down, seeing that it was us, and actually taking the phone call. That was very nice of you.
I'm happy to be here. It's great to join you.
I appreciate you filling in at the last minute. Bob Griffin and Sarah Rogerson, they had plenty of time to escape, and they didn't, and we appreciate that as well. Thanks to all. Have a beautiful day. We'll be back right after this.